So last week, I had just finished putting the daily worship guide together for this first week in Hosea when I came across one of those year-end lists. It was something like 2017's most viral stories. And I'm sort of always interested in what people are willing to share, and viral, whatever they are, means that a lot of people are sharing them for some reason. And as I made my way through this list, I got to number one, and I was a little bit surprised because I had seen the meme on Facebook and Twitter several times throughout the year, but I never really thought about how popular it was. And so I checked a couple other lists, and over, this is like the most shared meme in 2017. And the meme is called The Distracted Boyfriend. And it started with this stock photo that John has for us. So I did not buy the image, so it's marked by its owner. So, The Distracted Boyfriend. I saw this meme for the first time, actually, when one of my conservative friends shared it. He'd been getting frustrated online with all of the online debates he was having with Bernie Sanders supporters. And so this is the version of the distracted boyfriend meme that he shared. That one? The idea is that of the meme is really simple. The youth are easily distracted by socialism as she walks by. Even though they're in a relationship with capitalism, there's this attraction to socialism that pulls their gaze. This was my friend's meme. He was pretty excited about it. I don't know if he made it. He just shared it. Because I'm a nerd and I did a little bit of research, the version of this image that actually kicked off its popularity showed up on a progressive rock music page. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with Phil Collins, but here you can see Phil Collins in a relationship with progressive rock, but turning back to look at pop music. In this meme, right, you catch the idea that by turning back to pop music, Collins is somehow being unfaithful to his prog roots. In the spirit of Christmas, which just ended, we've got a special Christmas version. No words are even needed for this meme, just Photoshopped heads. This image perfectly captures the yearly temptation we face to make Christmas about Santa rather than Jesus, right? You can find thousands of these. All of these I have drawn from the internet. A number of them actually draw on Bible stories, like this one from the book of Genesis, where a man named Lot was married to a woman. They were fleeing their home, which was Sodom, and she turns back to Sodom and is turned into a pillar of salt. So, you can see the genders of the people don't matter, whether they're people or place it, like it doesn't matter. This meme just works really well for all sorts of things. If you use the daily worship guide this week, if you were listening to the scriptures that were read for us this morning, you probably already know why this meme got my attention. In the very first passage we read this morning, Hosea chapter 2, verse 5, we heard the Lord say, "For their mother has played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink." The Lord here is speaking about Israel's unfaithfulness to him. And hopefully you can connect the characters, the figures to the meme, right? The distracted boyfriend has become the distracted wife, Israel. The Lord is shocked and sort of disgusted as the partner. And then you have the lovers walking by, lovers who attract the wife with all of the things that they can give her, the bread and the water and the wool and the oil. This morning's passage is about a love triangle. Israel is caught in the middle between Yahweh and other gods. Now, Yahweh is the personal name of Israel's God. When you read your Bible and you read the word Lord and all of the letters are capitalized, this means that in the Hebrew text behind it, this is the personal name that God gave to Israel. Yahweh is the one who showed up and he made these covenant promises to men, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Yahweh is the one who heard the cries of his people as they were in Egypt. Yahweh is the God who rescued Israel from their slavery in Egypt and renewed his covenant with them. Israel is caught between Yahweh and the other gods. And the other gods are just that. They are other than Yahweh. They are the gods that Israel's neighbors have always worshiped and they have always trusted. And as you read the story of Israel, you notice again and again that Israel has always been a pretty small and mostly insignificant people in the world. Other than a brief moment under King David, under King Solomon, Israel has mostly existed under the shadow of other bigger, more powerful nations. And so as this small people, you can imagine how Israel's, the nation's gods have always had some sort of lure or appeal to them. And I want to explain this attraction a little bit because as we work our way through the book of the 12, these 12 books that we refer to as the minor prophets, this is a central issue that comes up over and over and over again. But it goes like this. If someone is bigger than you or stronger or richer or more influential and you want what they have, you want to be like them, then we typically start to imitate them in some way. This is actually what the entire self-help industry is all about. Read somebody's books or blogs. How did someone lose weight? How did someone start a successful business? How did someone gain online fame? Read their stuff. Begin to adopt their values. Imitate them, and you too could look like them, succeed like them, live like them. Right? I mean, we're familiar with this. Well, in the ancient world, this sort of competition, this sort of measuring up was all about your gods. Whoever had the strongest gods went the furthest, built the biggest, became the richest, which meant that if someone had a stronger god than you, you could begin to worship their god too and gain some of the blessing that he had given their people. And if you gave more to that God, if you won over his affection, he could actually become your God. And as long as you just kept the gods happy, they would stay with you. They would work for you. They would work to keep you happy. But, and this is the craziness of the ancient world, if you didn't do enough for your God, if you fell short in some way, and you usually didn't know what way, or if someone swooped in and won your God's affection, well, there was nothing you could do to keep your God from abandoning you for your neighbor. You are out of luck. And so let's take a look at our distracted boyfriend meme one more time. The gods of the ancient world were like the distracted boyfriend. The gods might be with someone, right? They might be the gods of Egypt or Syria or Babylon, but the gods always had a wandering eye. and could easily be tempted by some other nation who would do more for them. It's interesting that in this meme, we could replace the distracted boyfriend with either the gods of the nations or Israel. The gods had a wandering eye, and according to the Lord, so does Israel. But this makes perfect sense if it's true that we become like what we worship. If Israel worships unfaithful gods, if Israel worships gods who cannot be trusted to keep a commitment, gods who break their promises, gods who are fickle and who follow their bellies, well, Israel will become unfaithful people who cannot be trusted to keep their promises because they are fickle and they follow their bellies. The Lord announces this is exactly what Israel has become. Using the super provocative language of prostitution, Hosea chapter 2 makes it clear Israel is for sale. She will give herself away to the highest bidder. Israel at this point in the story doesn't just have a wandering eye. They're well past that. Israel has left the Lord and has gone chasing other gods down the street. And it's interesting what Israel has gone looking for from these other gods. In verse 5, we were told that Israel went after her lovers, who gave her bread and water, wool and flax and drink. In other words, she's looking for her providers. Someone has been keeping her alive, feeding her, clothing her. And when she looks around, she sees a couple of things. Times have been tough for Israel at this point in their history. The country's divided. They've been defeated over and over in battle. They've had some famines. They've had some other struggles. And at the same time that she sees how hard life has been for her, she also notices that her neighbors seem to be thriving and eating well. And so even though Israel is just surviving, she begins to assume that it's her neighbors' gods who have been feeding her. Clearly, Yahweh, Israel's God, hasn't been coming through on his side of the bargain. He's just not really doing it for them anymore. This is your classic green grass scenario. For Israel, the grass looks greener on the other side. And so in verse 7, we're told what Israel does about it. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them, not get them. She shall seek them, but shall not find them. Israel will go looking for these other gods. And in the words of the great band U2, we think, I have climbed the highest mountains. I have run through the fields only to be with you. I have run, I have crawled, I have scaled these walls, these city walls, only to be with you. But I still haven't found what I'm looking for. The Lord says she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Israel will go looking for greener grass, but the moment Israel gets there, Israel will do the same thing to that grass that she did where she was before. She will kill it. And we keep reading in verse 7. Then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Such an incredible and heart-wrenching twist in the story, right? Israel, as the distracted wife, has lost faith in Yahweh, who has been walking with her every step of the way, her husband and her provider. But Israel has lost faith, so much so that she's begun to look at the things that she has, her food, her water, her clothing, and her wealth, and she doesn't see the Lord as the giver of these gifts. In fact, talk about betrayal. We just read that Israel is using the gold and the silver that Yahweh has given her, and she is re-gifting it, re-gifting them as gifts for Baal and other gods. Right? If you were offended by somebody re-gifting something you gave them, but they not only re-gift it, but they re-gift it to your enemy, this gets close to the idea here. And so Israel leaves Yahweh and goes searching for these other gods. But we're told that she won't find what she's looking for. And there's a really simple reason for this. What she's looking for doesn't exist. Like, this might seem like a sort of duh statement for us. Like, but in the ancient world, the possibility of many gods existing was the dominant belief in the world. Even though Yahweh attempts to undo this belief in the Israelites at every point in their story, they just have a hard time shaking it. And while it might seem silly to us that people would believe in multiple gods, I think that there's something in their experience that can help us recognize and resist the temptation to be unfaithful. Whether it's a commitment to God, or whether it's a commitment to our spouse, or a job, or a church, or something, anything that we've made a promise or a commitment to, there is often a lie of some sort, or a number of lies that we have believed that tempt us to be unfaithful. If the grass looks greener on the other side, one of the lies that we've been telling ourselves is that it's probably the other person's fault. Right? We start to blame whoever it is that we're committed to. If marriage isn't going well, it's my spouse's fault. So if I leave and find greener pastures, things will be better. If life isn't going well, maybe it's God's fault. If work isn't going well, it's my company's fault. And so we seek to blame. Or another way that we lie to ourselves is by looking at what we have. Maybe it's our income or our home or our family or our possessions. And we begin to believe the lie that we did something, that we're super special in our abilities, that we did something to deserve these things. We earned them. God didn't help us with them. Our spouse didn't do anything to help provide them. We could have earned all of this at any job. We're just that good. And so we want the stuff, the lifestyle, the possessions, the family, but without the one who either gave them to us or at least helped us get there. Can you hear the different lies that are at work in these? When things aren't going well, we take less of the blame. When things are going really well, we take more of the responsibility. When things look better somewhere else, we deserve to be happier. Whatever the lie is, it creates a wedge between you and your partner. Again, whether that's God or a spouse or a business partner or a friend, the sense that you're not in this together. They've wronged you. You're carrying them. You deserve something else. Whatever the wedge, it makes you susceptible. The moment then someone walks by offering you, offering to set you free, offering to give you what you think you've been looking for, you become the distracted boyfriend. Unfaithfulness is the path that you are on. And as Israel teaches us, you will seek, but you will not find, because the thing that you are looking for is a lie. You let it take hold in your mind, and you allowed yourself to believe that it was real, but it doesn't exist, at least not in the form that you imagined. And so eventually you will find yourself looking back, longing for what you had, realizing what you had was real, and now you have nothing, because what you were looking for just doesn't exist anywhere except your imagination. I think in this way that the distracted boyfriend meme is this powerful visual warning for us. To have wandering eyes is a dangerous place to be. Whether those eyes are wandering from God or from your spouse or from whatever other commitments you have made in your life, wandering eyes mean that there may be lies at work in our hearts and in our minds, creating discontentment in us, leading us to look elsewhere for something that we promised to find in this relationship, whatever it is. Reflecting on our own temptation to be unfaithful, we then ask the question, so what happens when we have been unfaithful? What is God like? What does God do when we've been unfaithful? How does God respond? For Israel, they constantly struggled with the distinction between Yahweh and the gods that their neighbors created. Like I said earlier, they were attracted to their neighbor's gods. Their neighbor's gods actually made perfect sense to them. Like we noticed earlier, humans act a lot like the gods of Israel's neighbors. And why is that? Why do the gods of Israel's neighbors look so much, sound so much like humans? The Bible tells us that these gods were made in the image of humanity. Remember, we were made in the image of Yahweh. But humans, corrupted by sin, with disordered desires, minds set on the flesh, are pretty good at creating gods who look a lot like us, who take all of our worst features and we project them on divine beings who are running the world. And the gods, they become just like us, just more powerful. And this is essentially what Greek mythology was. This tends to be what most people are more familiar with. But if you read these stories, they're basically a bunch of glorified men and women with superpowers running around behaving badly. And there was something really justifying about these stories. If this is what the gods are doing, surely we can as well. And this is Israel's problem. They had a really, really hard time believing that their God was different. And this is what I love about the First Testament. What an honest assessment of their own life this book is. Constantly saying, man, we struggle to really believe that our God is different than all of the gods that we would make on our own. And I think when we're really honest, sometimes when we look at some of the things that we do and the ways that we live and the ways that we interact with God, I think that in us are often some distorted, broken ideas about who God is, that he's truly different Israel often wondered, if God is with us, but he sees someone better walking along, why wouldn't he turn and walk away from us? We've been so much trouble for him. You can hear this constant question through the First Testament. Israel wants to know if they can really trust that Yahweh is going to be faithful to them. Or is Yahweh a distracted boyfriend like every other god in the world? Or if God isn't the distracted boyfriend, what happens when we have been the distracted boyfriend? Does God turn into a bitter and jealous monster? Again, the way that the gods of their neighbors turned. Scorned and humiliated. Does God pay back his people for turning away from them and humiliating him? This is interesting. Chapter 2 in Hosea, we keep reading in verse 13. This is an uncomfortable verse because it says, the Lord says, I will punish her for the feast days of the Baals when she burned offerings to them and adorned herself with her ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, declares the Lord. I don't know about you, but this sounds exactly like the gods of Israel's neighbors. Punish people who wrong you. Make people pay when they hurt or they embarrass you. And it sounds exactly like every jealous lover I've ever seen in any movie ever, right? Yahweh sounds just like this if we don't keep reading. But we have to keep reading because the next word is therefore. Everything that follows is a response to what has just been said. And this is incredible. Therefore, this is how the Lord is going to punish his unfaithful people. I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. That doesn't sound like punishment. He goes on, and we heard this earlier, as Jane read it. No, Penny read this one. He goes on to promise himself to her. He offers to bless her with abundance. He wants to give her hope. He wants to restore what she has given up. The Lord offers to be her husband after she's been unfaithful to him. And then he reaffirms his covenant promises to her. He offers himself saying she can be in right relationship with him. He promises to work for her good. He promises to love her with an enduring love. He promises to show her mercy when she falls short. He promises to be utterly faithful to her. Like, you know what this sounds like? I will, I will, I will. Sounds a lot like I do. These sound like wedding vows. And God's punishment doesn't exactly sound like what we would call punishment. But actually, his punishment reminds me of Paul's instructions in his letter to the Romans when he says, let love be genuine. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good, Paul says. How do you hate what is evil? Well, Paul goes on. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. The punishment you give to the evildoer will be kindness that will feel nearly unbearable in the light of the wrong that they have done to you. What do you do when someone is unfaithful to you? You hate their unfaithfulness by overcoming it with good. Like if your enemy has hurt you, you bless them. If someone has been unfaithful to you, you be even more faithful to them because this is what God does. That this is who God is. According to the scriptures, the book of Hosea opens with God directing Hosea to love faithfully a woman who is going to crush his heart, who will reject him, who will turn from him, who will be utterly unfaithful to him. And yet, when all of this happens to Hosea, God tells Hosea to keep pursuing her, to remain committed to her, to not walk away. And God tells Hosea, this is who I am. I want you to show my people in your life, in your pursuit of this woman, that this is what I am like. Do this and show everyone who I am. That's how the book of Hosea opens, these chapters that we're looking at. In the book of the 12, that starts with Hosea and ends with Malachi, that we'll get to in like May, maybe later, sometime later this year, God is intensely invested in this message. When we get to it, in the book of Malachi, the last book of these prophets, God will declare, I hate divorce. Now, this isn't a definitive statement about those who somebody else has made them get divorced. This isn't anything like that, but it's a powerful statement that has a purpose. Because in Malachi, God holds the people's ability to maintain faithful marriages alongside their ability to remain faithful to him. In the first book of Hosea and the last book, Malachi, of these 12 prophets, God says, you cannot love me without loving your neighbors. It's not possible. You can't say that you love me if you do not love your neighbors. So let's look at how well you keep your word to others. Let's look at how well you keep your promises to others, how you commit to people and to communities. And so Hosea and Malachi together, they hold up a mirror for God's people. And what we see when we look at that mirror often says more about who we worship than our words ever will. But when Hosea and Malachi aren't holding up a mirror, they're holding up an image. It's an image that is really hard for the Israelites to see. It's an image that's hard for them to grasp, but it's an image of their God. But this God seems so foreign. And he calls himself holy. And for the Israelites, it functions, it feels more like a shadow than anything else. They struggle to grasp a hold of who this God is and what he is really like. But that shadow that's seen in the image that Hosea and Malachi hold up is connected to the one who would come and be for us the visible image of the invisible God. So on this Epiphany Sunday, we remember that Jesus came into the world as light to reveal to us the heart and the love, the grace and the truth of the Father. And it is in Jesus that we see definitively how God responds to his wayward, unfaithful creation. He bears with us. He suffers with us. He suffers for us. He suffers by us. He dies while we were still his enemies. But we hear Hosea speaking the word of the Lord, announcing, I will make for them a covenant. And as we look to the table together, our ears perk